agreement with the U.S., Iran promised not to build a nuclear weapon, which it always promised before. It also pledges to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, which was open before the war. So what did the U.S. gain? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Immigration authorities use facial recognition technology on immigrants and protesters. Now they're giving their system to local police. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Photos go into a computer system and are stored for 15 years. NPR goes deep on fashion news. Tamara Keith checks out Michelle Obama's outfits at the Obama Presidential Center. And our Michelle meets the new head of Vogue. It's Thursday, June 18th. This day in 1812, the U.S. declared war against Great Britain. 2 years later, their peace deal left both sides roughly where they had started. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Americans continue to not feel great about the economy or President Trump's leadership. NPR's Stephen Fowler reports the latest NPR PBS News Marist poll released this morning has more details.
President Trump faces his largest ever gap between those who approve of his job and those who don't. The disapproval is driven by nearly all Democrats, about two-thirds of independents, and one in five Republicans. When asked about how Trump is handling the economy, the numbers are even worse. Only a third of Americans say they approve, a figure lower than any point during former President Biden's tenure. One reason, gas prices. Even though the average price per gallon has decreased by about 40 cents in the last month per AAA, three-quarters of voters say it still puts a major strain on their finances. Stephen Fowler, NPR News.
Ukraine launched a wave of overnight drone attacks on Russia. The majority targeted the city of Moscow. As NPR's Charles Means reports from the Russian capital, it was one of the largest Ukrainian attacks on Moscow since Russia launched its full-scale invasion of its neighbor more than 4 years ago.
Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin said city air defenses destroyed some 180 Ukrainian drones on approach to the capital, but acknowledged several managed to strike a key oil refinery. Videos circulating online showed drones repeatedly striking the facility, causing large explosions, and another drone slamming into an apartment building. Plumes of smoke massed along the Moscow skyline, and all four of the city's airports suspended operations. In recent months, Ukraine has upped attacks on Russian energy infrastructure in a bid to dent the Kremlin's war chest. In a statement, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky justified the latest attacks as a response to Russian bombing of Ukrainian cities, adding it was time for the Kremlin to end the war. Charles Maines, NPR News. Moscow.
In the state of Georgia, House Republicans have paused redrawing the state's congressional and state political maps. The news came during a special legislative session yesterday. From member station WABE, Dormaya Vance has more.
Georgia lawmakers were called into special session to consider, among other issues, redrawing the 2028 map. Critics say the move would have weakened the political power of black and non-white voters in the state, but by the early afternoon, House Speaker John Burns announced this.
House Republicans will not be taking up congressional or legislative redistricting maps for the 2028 election cycle during this special session.
Republican Governor Brian Kemp called the special session after the Supreme Court weakened the Voting Rights Act. Multiple southern states have since redrawn maps. Kemp says redistricting conversations are deferred until a later date. For NPR News, I'm Dormaya Vance in Atlanta.
On Wall Street, in pre-market trading, NASDAQ futures are up 1.5%. You're listening to NPR. President Trump says he has signed the memo of understanding to stop the fighting with Iran. Trump says he signed a digital version of the memo while he was dining yesterday with French President Emmanuel Macron in the Palace of Versailles. Iranian state news media say Iranian officials have also signed it. The memo lays out a 60-day framework that reopens the Strait of Hormuz. Iran reaffirms a prior promise not to build a nuclear weapon. The Food and Drug Administration is convening an independent advisory committee today. It will consider the first flu vaccine that uses the same technology as the COVID-19 shots. NPR's Rob Stein explains.
The FDA advisors will examine a flu vaccine made by Moderna that uses mRNA technology. The meeting is noteworthy because of Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s intense criticism of the same technology used to make the COVID shots. In fact, the FDA stunned Moderna earlier this year when the agency refused to even consider the vaccine. The FDA quickly reversed that decision after an uproar in the biotech industry. The top FDA officials at the time have since left the agency. In an FDA review released this week, while raising some questions about the vaccine, generally gave the mRNA shot positive reviews. Rob Stein, NPR News.
The remnants of Tropical Cyclone Arthur are streaming over Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. Forecasters say it will still pour heavy rain and trigger strong winds. There have been tornado warnings this morning near New Orleans. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures Classics with Unidentified, a new mystery directed by Haifa Al-Mansour. A female police clerk becomes obsessed with solving the murder of a teenage girl in Saudi Arabia. Starts Friday in theaters.
KEXE has been serving the community of northern Minnesota since 1976. I'm Heidi Holton, and Simon Gretton recently stopped by and told us why he supports KEXE.
The dearth of local news in rural America is, frankly, I think, a big problem for our democracy. And the model right here of KEXE filling in and having outstanding public radio reporters filling the news gap in a rural area like ours, if the whole country had that, then our democracy would be so much the better for it. First heard about that. Wow, I want to get behind that. So I've been upping my support ever since I heard about that, and I will be continuing to do so because that is just a gift and asset to our neighborhoods, to our towns, to our region and the country and the world.
Do your part. Go to KEXE.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Martinez in Los Angeles, California. President Trump signed the agreement with Iran intended to end the war and get oil flowing again through the Strait of Hormuz.
The United States says it is prepared to lift decades of sanctions, potentially allowing hundreds of billions of dollars to flow to Iran. In return, Iran repeats its promise never to build a nuclear weapon, a promise Iran has made for decades and that U.S. officials usually have not believed. The idea now is to spend 60 days negotiating terms to back up that promise.
Coming up, we'll hear from one of the negotiators of the last Iran nuclear deal. But to break down the agreement now in hand, we're joined by NPR's Greg Myrie in Tel Aviv. So, Greg, there was supposed to be a big U.S.-Iran signing ceremony in Switzerland on Friday. What changed?
Yeah, we got a last-minute surprise. Trump and Iran's president signed the formal agreement Wednesday. Iran's leader did it in his home country. Trump did it at the French Palace of Versailles. Now, we know Trump is enamored with such opulence, but historically, this is where a treaty ending World War I was signed, a treaty ultimately considered a failure. So there's no need for that ceremony planned Friday in Switzerland, though we are hearing the U.S. and Iran may go ahead and meet and just start working on the final agreement that still needs to happen.
Okay, so I saw that President Trump spoke at length about the deal and also took questions from reporters. What jumped out at you?
Yeah, many things. I'll just mention two. First was Trump's language. He said he didn't want to be another Herbert Hoover, the president who presided over the Great Depression. He also said oil supplies would be depleted in another 4 weeks if the war had gone on. So remember, in the early days of the war, Trump was calling for Iran's unconditional surrender. Now he says he's ending it to avert an economic catastrophe. And second, this deal is designed to end the war, yet Trump was still using belligerent language, saying he reserves the right to resume the war.
If I don't like it, if they don't behave, We'll go right back to dropping bombs right smack in the middle of their head.
And he talked about bombing Iran a half dozen times at this press conference.
All right, so what should we be on the lookout for first out of this agreement?
Yeah, the Strait of Hormuz opening. Everybody wants this, perhaps Iran most of all. It needs to export oil for its crippled economy. So there may be logistical issues like clearing Iranian mines, for example, but everyone is expected to look for solutions, not create problems here.
President Trump says Iran's nuclear program is the most important issue. So how are those negotiations shaping up?
Yeah, this is going to be the hardest issue to resolve. And the memorandum says both sides will freeze in place as they negotiate. Iran won't work on its nuclear program. The U.S. won't impose more sanctions. But there's a lot of tough issues here. And the most important is what happens to nearly 1,000 pounds of highly enriched uranium. These negotiations are supposed to last 60 days, but that deadline can be extended.
All right, so what else can the U.S. and Iran expect out of this preliminary deal?
Well, the U.S. is getting two things it had before the war, the opening of the Strait of Hormuz and an Iranian promise not to have a nuclear weapon. This raises a key question. What did the U.S. gain from this war? Well, Iran has a lot to gain. Iran can now sell its oil freely. This is a huge immediate benefit. And a final agreement would call for the lifting of all U.S. and U.N. sanctions. Now, that's a big if, but the U.S. has squeezed Iran since the 1979 revolution there with all sorts of punitive measures. For the first time, Iran could begin to operate without all these restrictions.
That's NPR's Greg Myrie in Tel Aviv. Greg, thanks.
Sure thing, eh?
We've called someone who negotiated with Iran in the past. Rob Malley was U.S. Special Envoy for Iran in the Biden administration, and before that, a lead negotiator in the Obama administration for the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran. He's now at Yale and joins us. Rob, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
What do you make of this text now that you've seen it?
So, listen, I'd say the text is ambiguous, but at least it ends the war in Iran. Hopefully it also ends the war in Lebanon. It opens the Strait of Hormuz. I think it's also the MOU is also an indictment of the war that led to it for all the reasons we just heard. But at this point, far better than the alternative, which was to continue the conflict.
It sounds like you think this is a bad deal. It's just that it was a bad war.
I wouldn't call it a bad deal. When people say that Iran is getting so much out of this. I mean, let's put things in perspective. The war cost them hundreds of billions of dollars. Devastation of their infrastructure. People are talking about Iran losing 10% of their GDP this year. So compared to that, the economic benefits they're going to get out of this deal are peanuts. And I think the main thing is to make sure this memorandum of understanding holds and then learn the lesson, two lessons. Number one, that the war itself was the original sit that led only to a military defeat for the United States and a global economic crisis. And secondly, the answer to military force when it doesn't work is not more military force.
Our colleague Greg Myrie just now noted something. The president has talked of it as a big deal that the Iranians say in this agreement that they don't want a nuclear weapon. But haven't they always said they don't want a nuclear weapon?
Of course. This is the mystery and the oddity of President Trump, who could try to make something that is banal look like a historic achievement. But if that's what it takes for him to say that this is a good deal, I'm fine with it.
The challenge, of course, always has been assuring the United States and others that Iran actually isn't going to get a nuclear weapon. How do you go about doing that?
Well, that's really the challenge of the next deal. I think the question of the nuclear negotiations that are going to follow, that's going to be far more complex. I see no way in which it could be reached within the 60 days that the two parties have allotted to it, because it's not just what you just mentioned, which is going to be an extraordinarily challenging task. How do you really have the verification measures in place when Iran now, its nuclear program has been opaque for a very long time? And secondly, how do you devise the sanctions relief that the U.S. has promised Iran? That's going to take a long time. We may never get there. And if we don't get there, hopefully we at least maintain the truce that currently exists.
I take your point that Iran has suffered tremendous economic damage because of the war. Nevertheless, people were outraged in 2015 when you negotiated an agreement that included, I think, $1.7 billion for Iran. We're now talking about hundreds of billions of dollars potentially of investment in Iran. Could Iran use that money to support its regional proxies, do things the United States and Israel and others really wouldn't like?
First, the key word here is potentially. I mean, this is all premised on the notion that this bigger deal that I mentioned will be reached. There's so many question marks about that economic relief, the $300 billion investment that will be done in Iran. Who's going to invest that amount? The president has spoken about lifting all sanctions, which is extraordinary, but I assume that the price they're going to require of Iran to get there is going to be quite high, and again, it may never be achieved. But if the notion, and you know, I have to give President Trump credit on this, and among the enormous blunders and crimes that he's committed, every now and then he stumbles on the right instincts. If, in fact, you could change the relationship with Iran to the point where they are integrated in the world economy, but their international posture will have to change, their regional posture will have to change, why not? I don't think it's particularly likely, but to keep that out there, that at some point the U.S. should normalize its relationship with Iran. This macabre dance between the two has gone on for way too long. You know, it's a dream. I think it's good to put it out there. I suspect it's going to be quite a while before we reach that point.
After the nuclear deal in 2015 in the Obama administration, Congress passed a law requiring that any agreement over Iran's nuclear program from then on would have to pass through Congress. Is it your understanding of the law that this agreement has to be voted on by Congress?
I mean, a literal reading of the law is very hard to escape the fact that this should be voted on by Congress. In fact, some of the sanctions relief that the president has promised in this deal, in theory, cannot be implemented for another 30 days. So it's problematic. I suspect the administration is going to try to ignore and circumvent the law, and I'm not sure who can enforce it. So you're right. In theory, according to the way the law was written, this should be submitted to Congress. Let's see what happens.
Rob Malley, thanks so much for your insights. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
He was involved in negotiating the first nuclear deal with Iran back in 2015.
Interest rates are holding steady for now. NPR's Scott Horsley reports on what the Federal Reserve's next move might be.
There's a new chairman at the Federal Reserve. Kevin Warsh spoke to reporters yesterday for the first time since taking over at the central bank.
It's an honor, a true honor to be back at the Federal Reserve and to take up this duty at a time of such consequence.
President Trump chose Warsh for the job in hopes he would slash interest rates. But with a wartime spike in energy prices pushing inflation above 4%, rate cuts seem unlikely anytime soon. In fact, Fed policymakers signaled their next move is likely to be a rate increase. Financial markets didn't much like that message. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 500 points yesterday. But Warsh insists he and his Fed colleagues are determined to bring stubborn inflation under control.
The commitment to deliver is strong, unanimous, and unambiguous. And that's, I think, an important message. We've missed for 5 years, and we're going to fix that.
That may be easier said than done. The Fed fights inflation by raising interest rates, which tempers demand. But it does little to address a supply shock like the one caused by the war with Iran, which has snarled oil tanker traffic in the Strait of Hormuz. A tentative ceasefire in the war may provide some relief, but energy analysts say it could take months to repair the physical and economic damage and bring prices back to pre-war levels. In the early weeks of the war, Fed policymakers still thought they'd be able to lower interest rates by a quarter percentage point this year. But updated forecasts released yesterday point to a quarter-point increase instead. Warsh himself did not offer a rate forecast. He's generally said the Fed should provide less forward guidance to avoid tying its hands in case conditions change. The new chairman's called for other reforms at the central bank. He's appointing a series of task forces to review how the Fed communicates with the public, how it tracks inflation and other economic indicators, and how it responds to innovations that could upend the economy, like artificial intelligence.
Each task force will serve an objective shared by everyone in the system. A Federal Reserve that is clear-eyed about its mission, fit for purpose, and focused on the future.
Warsh says the task forces will draw on experts from both inside and outside the central bank. He expects them to make recommendations by the end of the year. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
All
this year, we're celebrating 50 years of KAXC, the first rural public radio station in the nation. Creativity, news, music, people, conversations, all of that for 50 years.
It's just like I always like to say, you know, even a blind pig finds an acorn once in a while.
Well, you take care there.
All righty. Just before I leave, another philosophical thought here just come to me. Just remember this. One good turn gets most of the covers.
How does that work with the tomatoes rotating a crop? Can you plant tomatoes 2 years?
Time to talk local food again on this Wednesday morning, and we're talking about wild foods again. Today, Maggie, our guest this morning is Alma Christensen, and Alma has...
I'm Heidi Holton, and you can make a difference for the future of KEXC. Become a member. Go to KEXC.org. It is 6:20. Thanks so much for tuning in. It is Thursday morning, June 18th. And coming up next, we have our early bird fishing guide, Jeff Sundin. Current temperatures around the region, another chilly morning for a June day. We're looking at 46 degrees right now in Bagley, 49 in Hibbing, Bemidji 48, Brainerd 52, Grand Rapids at 49, Aiken reporting 52. And for the day, we're looking at temperatures in the mid-60s to upper 60s, breezy northwest winds up to 20 miles an hour. For tonight, mostly clear with temperatures in the mid-40s, northwest winds 5 to 10, gusting up to 20. And for tomorrow, Friday, chance of showers and thunderstorms, high 66 to 70, evening temperatures in the mid to upper 40s. Saturday's looking like sunny with highs 68 to 73 degrees. Support this morning comes from Ledger and Ladle, a restaurant in downtown Grand Rapids with a rotating menu every few months to explore a new region, technique, or ingredient. Open Wednesday through Friday, 3 to 9, Saturday, 5 to 9, Sundays, 10 to 2. More at ledgerandladle.com.
Gone fishing. Babble, 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 babble. There's a sign upon your door.
Pops, don't blab it around, will you?
Gone fishing.
Keep it shady. I got me a big one staked out.
You ain't working anymore.
I don't have to work. I got me a piece of Gary.
Cows need milking in the barn.
I have the twins on that detail. They each take a side.
But you just don't give a darn.
Give them 4 bits of cow and hand lotion.
You just never seem to learn.
Man, you taught me.
You ain't got no ambition.
You're convincing.
Gone fishing. Got your hound dog by your side.
That's old Cindy Lou going with
you. Gone fishing.
Mm-hmm.
Fleas are biting at his hide.
Get away from me, boys. You're bothering me. Folks won't find us now because Mr. Satch and Mr. Cross, we gone fishing. Instead of just a wishing.
Bop-a, baby, bop-a, bop-a, bop-a.
Oh, yeah.
It is Thursday morning. It's time to check in with our early bird fishing guide, Jeff Sundin, who joins us now. Morning, Jeff. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. You're welcome.
Another chilly morning, and the days have been colder. How's it been out in the boat?
It's been a little odd. Yesterday was especially odd. I hadn't realized that it still rained here in Minnesota.
Yeah.
After 3 or 4 weeks of walking around on crunchy grass that felt like it was going to break when I stepped on it, got to spend the day. That's the first day this year, I think, that we sat in the rain out in the boat. So I was a little bit, I was excited about it because we need the rain. And as you know, I would rather do something like that than to be sitting on a calm lake on a sunny day, as far as the fish are concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed that as it's been kind of ratcheting down now. It wasn't that long ago on some of the smaller lakes, especially the darker water, the shallower lakes, were getting water temperatures up into the 72, 73, 74 degree neighborhood. And now, thanks to all of this cool weather that we've been having, they've sunken back down into the low mid-60s, depending on which lake. And obviously, they all hadn't warmed up that much. Clear lakes and deeper lakes were maybe up into the upper 60s or something like that. So on those, the impact of the reduction is a little bit less dramatic. But still, 63, 64, maybe the odd 65-degree reading over the past couple of days is quite a departure, you know, considering now we're moving into the kind of the summer peak time. And I think a lot of the cooler water temperatures are representing sort of a holdback on some of the fishing patterns and the conditions that we've been having. So we're seeing the jig and minnow bite, for example, is lingering longer than normal. By this time of the year, you would typically would expect to see some full-scale, you know, mayfly hatches or the caddis or midge hatches, things like that. And I have heard some reports. People in certain lakes have talked about seeing some mayfly hatches. For me, it's been minimal. I haven't seen a lot of evidence that there was many insect hatches going on. And I've been seeing quite a bit of evidence that the fish are still focusing on kind of a minnow-oriented presentation. Jig and minnow, for example, has continued to produce walleyes better than a night crawler or a leech or some of the other alternatives. I'm not saying that, I wouldn't want to say that you can't catch fish on leeches or night crawlers right now, because you can, and we have. But the jigging presentations are still, I think, have the advantage. It's a little bit faster in terms of the overall action throughout a day. I think we catch more fish. And then also, it's just a lot less. As much as I like wiggle worming, for example, or fishing with a live bait rig and a leech, it is a little bit more involved. You need to set some time for feeding the line and getting the slack back out before you set the hook. It's something nice about the nice compact presentation of putting a minnow on a jig, and you toss that into the lake and give it a couple of hops. And folks that do a lot of jigging know that kind of that sensation that you get when that fish first gets it. Sometimes it's a little pop at the end of the line, or just the sensation of pressure on the tip of your rod. There's something that's more exciting about that than a pickup when you're fishing with a Lindy rig, or even some of the other presentations like slip floats. And watching a bobber go down has its own kind of appeal, but still, you don't have that sensation, that feeling at the end of your rod tip. So I guess in that way, the extended jig and minnow period is a good thing, but I'll bet you can guess what makes it a bad thing. Not so much.
Yeah, what makes it a bad thing?
Okay, the minnow supplies at our bait stores in the region are drying up.
Oh.
And so what we've got left to use is, I think you called me on it about a year ago or so, when I called the minnow supply a bunch of stupid-looking fatheads. But that's what we're back to again. I have really seen some horribly poor quality minnows in the last few days. And folks that had been able to get shiners, the shiner supplies have pretty much dried up completely. And the alternative minnows, some of the dace and rainbows, or even larger size fatheads. Now, if somebody's got a bait shop or a resort and you've got some better minnows, don't take offense. I just haven't seen them yet. This would be a good time to drop me a line and get a free plug for your bait shop on the fishing report, because I haven't seen, I haven't seen any kind of minnows that I was very impressed with at all here within the last maybe 3 or 4 days. Even the last time that I was able to catch a bait store that had some shiners, there was like a teaser. There was a certain amount of nice-looking shiners in the tank, but then to help get rid of them, there was a whole bunch of little junk, too, just kind of mixed up stuff that who knows where it even came from. But if you put it all together in one basket, something about the human eye, you focus on the really nice-looking ones that are in the net, and then you forget about all that little stuff that's in there until you get out on the lake and you start weeding through them and sorting through them, and it doesn't take very long to figure out that you're getting about a 50-50 mix, if you're lucky, of good ones versus ones that most folks would just, you know, just throw away and not even use. I will say one thing about if you do have a supply, if you can find some decent shiners, this is the time of the year where it gets to be really hard to keep them alive. And rather than fighting that, a lot of times if I'm seeing the minnows, by the time you get to the lake, a lot of times they're already floating in the oxygen bag, or you put them into your minnow tank, and within a short amount of time, you start to see a lot of minnows floating. Whatever you do, don't throw those valuable minnows away. I just take those immediately as soon as I see them starting to float up. We wrap them in paper towels to keep the moisture down, and then put that on ice, like in a Ziploc bag. Put your little Ziploc bag with some paper towels. Keep it on ice, and you can continue to use those minnows. Despite them being dead, you can use those for all of the fishing day, and in some cases, if you really keep them nice and cold and fresh, you can even use them the next day to a certain point. They will get soft and unusable before, you know, too much time passes, but they should not be thrown away. You should save them and use them, and they work just as well. In fact, there was one particular time that we were fishing on a lake, and it seemed pretty obvious to us that the fish were showing a preference. They would rather have the dead ones versus the live ones. And I surmised that, you know, as the color fades, that the paler looking minnow maybe was a little bit more appealing to the fish, or they could see it easier, something that made it stand out from the other ones. So don't be afraid to experiment with that sort of thing.
All right. So don't just make that rash decision to get rid of them if they're floating.
Especially not when you're talking about minnows that are like a dollar a piece these days. So,
wow.
Yeah, hang on to them.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, we're talking about presentations and jigs and minnows. There was some legislation, and it was supposed to be taking effect in 2027, about lead tackle. There's lots of talk about this. Where are we at?
Well, right now, my understanding of it is that it did not pass in the last session, and I have reached out to my Senator Kerry Heintzman and Ben Davis, my district representative, hoping that I'll be able to talk with either or both about what the prospects are that this would still... That I'm kind of on the fence about this. I don't want... lead, if it's unnecessary item, I really don't want extra lead in the lakes. That's on one side of the argument. On the other side of the argument, I also don't want to ban something that really doesn't need to be banned. So anecdotally, you know, my experience is I'm on the water an awful lot. I don't really see a ton of dead birds and so on and so forth. I understand, like with lead shot, there was plenty of evidence. You could see that if you cleaned a duck or whatever, you could find lead shot in the gizzards of the ducks, and you could see it with your own eyes. Finding that evidence is a little trickier when it comes to birds. So what I've asked for is some scientific evidence, some support to suggest, you know, why in 2025, why did they introduce this? You know, was the ban really necessary? I hate to sound like a skeptic, but sometimes these things happen. It's an industry-driven thing where it would be a good idea for some certain company in the fishing tackle business to eliminate some of its competition by coming up with a technology that, you know, your average, you know, mom and pop sort of a shop can't really produce tungsten jigs like you can mass produce. So that's an idea that's floating around in the back of my mind. Either way, there will be a full-scale article coming out on this, and I'll keep you posted along the way. But as this unfolds, the people who can help me with it have to get back to me. I have gotten some feedback a little bit already, and they want to do their own research to find out, you know, what forms the opinion, and they'll share with that, and then I'll share with you as we go forward. At the moment, I can't see how it would be possible for this to pass and still take effect by July 1st of next year, but stranger things have happened. There could be some kind of a fast track thing. So as of right now, if you read either one of the bills, and I'll provide that in, probably won't make today's report, but I'll provide the text of the bill in tomorrow morning's report. It would ban not only the sale of lead sinkers and lead jig heads, it would ban the use of them too. So that means don't run out right now and try to stock up on them, because you wouldn't want to get stuck with a whole pile of things that you just can't take out and use. So kind of, you know, use what you've got, take advantage of it if you have it right now, and then be prepared for the switch. And you'll notice that a lot of the industry folks are already making this. I think there's about six, last I heard, there were six states in the country that have already banned lead fishing tackle, and a lot of the fishing lure companies, the larger ones especially, have just gone and taken the initiative, and they've gotten rid of it. So tungsten is a popular replacement. Bismuth is a replacement that one of the companies is using. When I was still in the fishing tackle business, we were trying to get ahead of this by producing fishing jigs that were made out of tin. And I still have a pretty good supply of that. So I've been fishing with the tin jigs for probably 15 years now. They're a little bit lighter in weight than the others, but they, in some cases, that lighter weight is actually an advantage when you're fishing in weeds and you don't want jigs plowing up and down through the weed patches. So something else to look at. And we'll keep you posted on the alternatives and so on and so forth as things unfold.
All right, so water temperatures have gone down again. Bait supplies are limited. Give us some help on what we should be putting together if we're headed out on the lake.
Yesterday was the beginning. Now, the conditions were perfect for it. There's nothing like a little drizzly day with some breeze blowing, and it kind of triggered the beginning of the mixed bag action bite. I was pretty lucky because I had a couple of guys that were interested. We had already fished for walleyes the day before, and we came really close to having their limit already. And they wanted to catch some perch. One of the fellas, he likes to catch basically whatever bites. So we went to Bowstring Lake and trolled spinners with those stupid fat heads on them and caught a mix of everything. As usual, dozens and dozens of small northerns, but we picked up keeper-sized perch, a little bit of panfish, some rock bass like we talked about last week that Bobby Harris, he likes to bring those home and eat them, so kind of rounded out. I'm going to call this the beginning of the mixed bag action bite time of the summer. We're just getting started on it, but I will say that the spinners, particularly the despite the cold water temperatures, the weeds are still developing, so it's getting easier to find patches of cabbage and coontail. And for us yesterday, perch was kind of the priority. We tried to harvest some of those, and while we were looking for perch, I discovered some flat kind of patches, 6 to 7 feet of water, with patches of eelgrass that are growing about 3 or 4 feet above the bottom of the lake. rather the cabbage weeds, the tall and really good green, healthy cabbage patches, they were holding some panfish and a lot of northern pike, but these patches of eelgrass seem to be the preferred hangout for the perch right now. So on your lake, if you can find some of those shallow flats, the eelgrass kind of looks like fuzzy stuff on the bottom, and I'm going to capture some images of that. That will also be in tomorrow morning's report, some updated photos of the habitat to watch for, and how to single out one kind of species in the weeds from another one. So start thinking about that, the spinners, and then you don't have to be so dependent on the supply of minnows for jigging right now either. I wouldn't use these small fatheads for jigging for walleyes, but on a spinner, the spinner is doing the lion's share of the work, and the bait that's on there is more or less just to provide some scent, you know, some attractant for the fish to believe that that's a live minnow and attack it. So you can kind of make up for lost time by doing it that way.
Before we go, Jeff, it's musky fishing opener. What should we know about that?
Well, this might be another one of those things. Without being out there doing it yet, it's hard to say for sure. But with that, the cooler water temperatures and the emphasis, fish still feeding on minnows and so on and so forth, this could be a good time for the casual. The advanced musky anglers, they all already know what they're going to do. But there's folks like me who enjoy fishing for them once in a while, but I don't call myself an expert on musky fishing. During these colder periods like this, typically the fish would have already moved away from the shallow water and it'd head out into the mid-lake parts of the better musky lakes, especially ones that have tulavies or whitefish that they feed on. But now with other bass, smallmouth bass, largemouth bass, still kind of working in the shallow water, a lot of times you'd be able to find muskies that are hanging. Picture a lake that's got a shallow, maybe a 2 or 3 foot sandy flat, or maybe there's a little bit of rock, and then there's a little edge where that drops down maybe from 5 feet into 8 or 9 or 10. The muskies like to follow that edge, right? The very shallow edge of those break lines. And one of my favorite tricks is to just creep along slow, get up on the shallow side, the opposite of what you would think, get up into that 2 and 3, 4 feet of water, keep the boat on the shallow side, and make your cast kind of parallel to the break line out towards the deeper water, and then retrieve that lure. This time of the year, large bucktails are a good choice. Jerk baits like a suic or any other wooden bait that you can kind of work 2 or 3 feet below the surface, cast it towards the deeper water, bring it across that drop off towards the shallow, and these fish that are holding along those edges, they'll see that, and if you drag them up, if you can get the fish to follow up onto the shallow water, it seems like they're a lot more likely to strike the lure rather than to just follow for a second and then disappear down into the deep. So that might be a trick to try for somebody that, especially if you don't musky fish a lot and you just need one idea that you can work on, follow those shallow sandy drop-offs on the better musky lakes, and you should be able to at least, we used to just be happy when we saw one, and that's the kind, that style of fishing helps ensure that you'll get a visual sighting home.
All right. It's going to be interesting to see what next week will bring and temperatures and lake water and all of that kind of stuff, Jeff. So you can read Jeff.
I'll be here. You'll
be telling us, I'm sure. And you can read Jeff's fishing reports. It's at jeffsundin.com. Have a great week. We'll talk to you next week.
You too.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you. See ya.
Bye-bye. Jeff Sundin talking about stupid fatheads. I love that.
Stupid fatheads and there's cabbage just, patches. And
I know all the words are mixed bags, all the stuff going on. We'd love to hear from you. If You've been out on the lake. I mean, he has seen a 6 to 7 degree difference in water temperature just because of these temperatures in the last week.
We have noticed that at our cabin. It was up to 74 degrees, and now it's back down to 68. And it's a deep lake, so mm-hmm. he was saying that the shallower lakes are actually even colder.
Mm, sure.
Yeah. Have you jumped in the last week?
I have not, no.
I became a real fair weather swimmer.
I'll
admit it.
We've had other stuff going on. I actually have not jumped in the lake yet this year, so.
Not at all this year?
No. No, I know. We'll be getting out a little more soon, so.
Yeah.
There you go.
You're listening to KAXE. Conversations like you just heard with Jeff Sundin each and every morning on our morning show. Coming up at 9 this morning, it is Headwaters with DJ Dang. Programming is supported in part by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. Introducing the 2026 Bush Fellows, leaders working to make the region better for everyone. More information is online at bushfoundation.org.
Coming up, we've got national Native news. We're learning about what's happening in the Navajo Nation when it comes to a Biden area resource management plan meant to focus on conservation and consultation with tribes. So stay tuned for that story. We'll also bring you the set list that is live music around our region. And then throughout our morning, we're checking in with rural women who are doing things in the community. We're going to be checking in with our news director, Chelsea Perkins, and talk about the stories that our all-female newsroom has been covering. And then we'll be talking with Nancy Lynn Meyer from Bovee. She's on the city council there, and there's lots of things happening in the small town of Bovee. And then Shanai Mattson and Annie Humphrey, they are involved in so many different things across communities where rural women are leading. So we'll hear about that story throughout our morning, and you are invited to join the conversation. Text us 218-326-1234.
It's going to be mostly sunny today, high 64 to 69 degrees, a little breezy from the northwest, 10 to 20 miles per hour.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas. Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument has been the target of Utah Republican Senator Mike Lee. He's been looking to undo a Biden-era resource management plan meant to focus on conservation and consultation with tribes. That effort has failed for now. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrasio has more.
Using the Congressional Review Act, lawmakers on Capitol Hill could have killed the plan with a simple majority vote from the Senate floor. But that 60-day window has closed.
Some people think it's a win, and I suppose in some sense it is, but I don't feel excited about it because I do think there's more coming. We've just thrown away something that could be another weapon.
Eric Stanfield is senior anthropologist with the Navajo Nation Heritage and Historic Preservation Department. He helped shape this years-long process. An executive order could still downsize this national monument, significant to Navajos, Hopis, Zunis, Utes, and Paiutes. Together, they formed an intertribal coalition.
Having to respond to this really strengthened the coalition. It bonded the group a little bit better. We organize, and that's going to persist.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrasio.
Authorities are looking for methods to close gaps preventing justice from being served when violent crimes happen on reservation settings. Now, the FBI, ATF, and tribal law enforcement are doubling down on these efforts. SDPB's CJ Keen reports.
They're calling it Operation Ballistic Backlog, and it falls under the ongoing effort Operation Steadfast Promise, which is aiming to solve cases that have troubled reservations and Native communities for decades. To put it simply, firearms leave something of a ballistic fingerprint, which can be traced if and only if prior uses of that firearm are documented into an ATF database. At the Rapid City FBI branch office, FBI agent Christopher Dotson goes into detail.
In South Dakota, Operation Ballistic Backlog is an initiative that is unique to the Pine Ridge Reservation. This initiative came about when we recognized an opportunity to work with our partners from the Oglala Sioux Tribe, Department of Public Safety, who had hundreds of firearms in their custody that we could help test against evidence found at various crime scenes. And this cache of weapons could be tested and entered into the ATF's National Integrated Ballistic Information Network, known as NIBIN.
Dotson is the special agent in charge of the Minneapolis field office, which covers Minnesota and the Dakotas.
What makes this initiative exciting is the potential to connect these guns to the unresolved crimes on the Pine Ridge Reservation and elsewhere.
This comes as the FBI announced a new reward for information in the search for a suspect in the death of 6-year-old Logan Warrior Goings, who was murdered in his Oglala family home.
Weeks later, a gun firing the same kind of ammunition used in Logan's murder was located well away from the crime scene. Ballistic testing connected that gun to the murder of little Logan, and that is a key piece of evidence. Last week, the FBI announced a $50,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person or persons responsible for Logan's senseless murder. Somebody out there knows something.
In total, over 500 firearms are now slated to be tested for potential links to cases across the nation. For National Native News, I'm CJ Keen in Rapid City.
And I'm Jill Freitas.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation.
Thanks so much to National Native News. It's one of the news sources we bring you here on People Powered KEXE. Things like the Canadian Broadcast Corporation, the news of the afternoon at 6 o'clock every day, and Morning Edition, which you'll be hearing throughout today's broadcast, as you do always, and our local newsroom. So we bring it to you to have this mix of things that we think keep us going and connected and aware of what's happening locally and in the world.
Yeah, this is People Powered Radio. You can support us with membership. Go to KAXE.org, as little as $5 a month, or honestly, even just sharing stories that you've heard on the air, going to our website and sharing those with people who might be interested. That is a huge help to KAXE. We receive support from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, a broadband cooperative featuring all fiber optic GigaZone internet speeds up to 10 gig and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net.
That's a great story. You can read and find out about it at our website, kexc.org, including the latest Beyond the Voice spotlighting volunteers, Gina the Knife. Check that out. And we've also got a story about kid librarians who are shining at the Virginia Public Library. Can you imagine if you had the opportunity to be a kid librarian?
I was at recess. That was what I would do in elementary school.
I was in the basement in our house, but yes.
Also in my bedroom. But no, that would be amazing. I did stay in at recess to shelve books.
Of course you did. I was shelving in high school, so recess was gone. I helped shelve sheet music and band, you know.
Oh,
and stuff.
I was
Band-Aid.
Is that what they called you?
Yeah.
Was this around the time of Band-Aid?
Yeah, it would have been actually, but no, nobody really made that. It was very serious.
Oh,
I'm
sure.
Aiding the band. Yes.
Well, it wasn't like a joke, the Band-Aid?
No.
Oh.
No,
I thought it was a joke.
Okay. I got a credit for it even.
All right. Who thought of that name though? That's pretty great.
Yeah.
You're listening to Heidi Holton.
Yeah.
And I'm Kari Hedlund.
It's going to be one of those days. I'm excited for the conversations ahead and the music we'll be bringing you. But it's one of those days where I'm a little sleepy. I'm going to try to get some, hopefully it might get
fast and loose here. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah. And you think that more coffee is going to help.
Doesn't. Yeah. I mean, but it makes it more fun. So keep that going. Heidi.
I got to go fill her up. It's a pretty strong one. Yeah, so it's gonna be a good morning. We are getting ready for, there's so many things going on in northern Minnesota. We really want your help in telling us about community events, especially as we kick into the 4th of July celebrations throughout the small towns. Sometimes those are the things that, unless you live in the town, you don't always know what goes on. And so we want to know, we want people to know about the things they can do where they can meet other people and celebrate small towns. Let us know. You can text 218-326-1234. Maybe that is about where you get your ice cream or the secret information of like which store gives the largest ice cream cones.
I was just going to comment on this, Heidi, because yesterday you and Andrew had a good conversation about great.
Thank you.
Yeah. One good conversation yesterday.
Oh. Yeah.
About ice cream shops and particularly seasonal ice cream shops. All of this is my jam. I love finding these. And I got to tell you, yesterday picked up my daughter from camp and we were in the Longville area and went to Frosty's.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know Frosty's?
Yes.
Ooh, it was so good.
Yeah.
So many different flavors of hard ice cream.
Yeah. What'd you get?
I got a monster cookie one.
Oh, wow.
Delightful.
Okay.
Huh. There was a banana crunch one that was like chunks of banana with graham cracker crust and sort of like a banana cream pie type of thing.
Wow.
I almost got that one. I feel like a full serving would have been too much, but I tried it. It was very interesting.
Okay.
So as I was there, I was like, oh, we got to talk about this.
Cone?
I did a sugar cone.
Okay. All right.
What's your preference?
A waffle cone would be my...
Well, yes.
You know,
I mean...
If I could. A homemade waffle cone.
Yeah.
We've been talking about... Some people texted in yesterday and I talked about it this week too about my days of living in St. Paul and waiting in line at Grand Ole Creamery.
Oh, yes.
And the malted milk ball at the bottom of the homemade waffle cone.
Ooh.
That they always had there.
Mm-hmm.
We had someone texting in yesterday about that. The great flavors they have there, but we'd love to hear from you. I mean, there's even
Fresh Freeze in Wadena. Oh. That's another one. I will also say
Triangle Drive-In in Brainerd, in Northeast Brainerd. So as you come in, like if you're coming from Grand Rapids, the old mall, take a right there. It's right down the road.
Oh,
it's just seasonal and younger family have taken it over, but it's been there forever.
12-year-olds working, hopefully.
I don't know.
That's how mine was always in Aberdeen. It was like, I don't even think these kids are 14.
And there's a place in Reamer, like if you hadn't had your ice cream in Longville, you could have stopped there. It's just a convenience store, but they have the most giant ice cream cones.
Oh, see, yes, I did hear you talking about those convenience store places with hard ice cream. Mm-hmm. Those are little gems. We know the couple around here, and we will go specifically to those.
Right, right. There's one down on the way to Mille Lacs Malmo.
A Happy's?
A convenience store.
Yeah,
Happy's too.
Happy's is great.
Yeah. So we'd love to hear from you. Maybe it's a favorite flavor. Maybe it is the treat. Andrew loving I totally get it, the ice cream sandwich made of chocolate chip cookies.
Heck yeah. I can get down with that. What do you feel about a root beer float? Because it was like root beer float day yesterday or something.
Was it? It was like he was throwing at me the days, which was like a cherry tart and an apple strudel.
Yep, that was also.
Yeah. Oh, no, he did ask me what I felt about root beer. You're right. I'd rather just have a root beer, I think.
What about a Coke float?
No, thanks.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm.
No, but I used to love the Mr. Misty floats.
I don't know what that means.
Dairy Queen used to have Mr. Misty's.
Are those slushy things?
Yep.
Oh, and then you put ice cream in it?
Yeah, and you'd think, I would think I wouldn't like that, but I loved it as a kid.
That is a little intriguing.
Yeah. Yeah. Root beer float sounds pretty good, though, now that I say that.
My grandma was not the best. Grandma, somewhere you're probably listening, but she wasn't the best cook.
Yeah, mine either.
Okay. But she could serve a root beer float to anybody that came by her house.
What kind of root beer would she use?
Whatever she had.
Okay.
It wasn't, you know.
Yeah. Do you have I do love a homemade root beer that you can get at breweries.
Yes.
Boy, is that
Heck
good.
Yeah, when they're like bitter, but there's a bite to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I don't particularly love Barks. I like A&W.
Yeah, me too. I think
1919 is good. It's expensive, but it is good.
Barks has a little aftertaste, I think. You know?
Dad's? I don't really remember what Dad's tastes like.
Yeah, Dad's.
Dad's.
Come on. Let's find out about some of the live music going on in our region.
This is the Setlist on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons.
We are looking at four shows this Saturday and Sunday, June 20th and 21st, in Duluth, Deerwood, Aiken, and Grand Rapids. First up, the second year of Country Coveralls is Saturday at the Back Alley in Duluth. Three Minnesota artists are performing at the festival, with Americana singer-songwriter and pedal steel player Simon Cropp covering John Prine and Hank Williams, fan favorites Between Howl playing as a quartet covering Graham Parsons and Emmylou Harris, and folk singer Creekbed Carter Hogan covering Nancy Griffith and Roger Miller. Country Coveralls this Saturday, 4 p.m. in Duluth. Also Saturday, folk blues artist Bruce Archer is playing Rutgers Bay Lake Resort in Deerwood at 6 p.m. Archer just put out his second album, Some Days, Some Folks, showcasing his authentic country blues and heartwarming folk songwriting. Bruce Archer, 6 p.m. in Deerwood. One more for Saturday is songwriter Aaron Tank at Sampaguita in Aiken at 7 p.m. Tank writes questioning songs that explore life's big questions, and he also leads the rock band Stardust Collective, 7 p.m. Saturday in Aiken. And one for Sunday, LaPlante Road with Landon Paul at the Rife Center in Grand Rapids at 2